welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to Syosset Library's Turn the Page podcast. I am Jessica. I am one of your hosts. And with me, we also have another wonderful librarian host. Please tell everyone who you are.
Sure. Hi, I'm Evelyn Hershkowitz, Reader Services Librarian. And with us today, we have author Amy Belding Brown. Amy's latest book is called Emily's House, which is about Emily Dickinson's house and her maid. So Amy Belding Brown wrote a rich new novel, Emily's House. It's narrated by Dickinson's longtime maid, Margaret Maher. Am I pronouncing that right?
Maher, okay. Yeah, probably.
Okay. Amy is the best-selling USA Today author of Emily's House, Flight of the Sparrow, and Mr. Emerson's Wife. Her short fiction and poetry has appeared in Yankee, Good Housekeeping, American Way, The Worcester Review, The Pucker Brush Review, and other national, international, and regional magazines. She's taught writing at Worcester State University, Fitchburg State University, and Granite State College. A graduate of Bates College, she received her MFA from Vermont College and now lives in her home state of Vermont with her husband, a UCC minister and spiritual director. You can learn more about Amy and her work on her website, her Facebook, her Twitter, and her Instagram. Emily's House is available here in the library and also on Overdrive. If you care to purchase the book, you could get it on bookshop.org and other platforms. So Amy, thank you so much for joining us today. I am loving this story. It is so great. I have a couple of questions before we even get started. There are some words in there, actually one word that you seem to be using a lot that I've never heard of, and I guess it must be an older word. It's Q-U-A-R-E.
That's queer. It's basically like queer, but not queer. It would be the way an Irish person would say it.
Okay.
So
look it up.
I didn't know
the word. So tell everybody what that word actually is.
It just means in the way I use it anyways, just right. Means strange.
Or strange.
Or queer, but not in a sexual sense.
Just right. Strange. But Q-U-A-R-E. And I was like, I don't know that word.
I was trying a little bit to get to so you could hear as you read it her accent.
Right. And you did a wonderful job of that. I'm really enjoying the Irishness of it and the New England, and it takes place in Amherst. Am I pronouncing that one right?
Amherst.
Okay. I'm from Long Island, so well, I don't know all the towns up there. I'm sorry.
Lots of people in Massachusetts don't pronounce it. Oh, okay. Right.
I am very well acquainted with Emily's House because, and as Evelyn knows, my brother and sister-in-law both met up at UMass Amherst, and I called it Amherst for the longest time. And then I think finally when my brother was actually moving up there and decided he was just going to go full New England, he just was like, it's Amherst, stop calling it Amherst. Right. Not which is why I know
people all over. I've heard it mispronounced more often than I've heard it correct. So it's okay. Mostly just this little area where people are really
okay. So I don't feel so bad about it. But you certainly bring out the character of the town, and I want to go. I haven't been there. I really have to get there. So what inspired you to write Emily's House?
Well, it's kind of, I like to write fiction based in history. And I was looking for a different period of time because I'm always interested in exploring sort of new things. But I also, Emily Dickinson is, because I grew up wanting to be a writer and a poet and all that. She's always sort of there, especially if you're interested in poetry. And if you're not in New England, it's not just New England by a long shot, but So she was always sort of in the background. My aunt, who I dedicated the book to, was a great and very influential in my life. She was a great lover of Emily Dickinson's poetry and her life. And she, when we visited with her, she often would just quote some of Emily's poems just off the top. She had them, some of them memorized. And also, my grandmother lived in nearby Northampton. And so when we visited her, we sometimes went to Amherst. At that point, that was a long time ago, and the house wasn't a museum, but we would pass it, and it always looked sort of mysterious to me behind its hedge. At that point, it was like a lot of trees were growing up, and the hedge had turned into trees, hemlock trees, and so it was sort of hidden. It looked mysterious. And then when I did read a little about her, she seemed very mysterious. So I was curious about her as much as anything. And so one of the reasons I like writing these novels is to just satisfy my curiosity about the person I pick. So I started out thinking I would write something with Emily Dickinson's in her world. I actually thought at one point maybe I'll try to do it from her point of view, but I very quickly realized that I didn't think I could capture the way she thought adequately and the way she wrote and spoke. And so I realized I couldn't do it from her point of view, but someone close to her. And I was sort of searching around for different things. I was reading a lot of biographies of her, and I came across this book, Made as Muse, by Aoife Murray, which is a fascinating book. It's a close examination of the servants in the Dickinson family, a whole bunch of different servants, black servants. The Native Americans were somewhat involved, if not, I don't think they were directly servants, but they were tradespeople sometimes, and a lot of Irish people in that world. And if you read that book, you know Margaret Maher stands out. She was a long-term maid with the Dickinsons, who worked for them from about 1869 until Lavinia Dickinson, Emily's sister, died in 1899. So there's about 30 years. So she was there for the last 17 years of Emily's life. And once I read the fact that she had actually sort of saved the poems had been hidden in her trunk, all the poems that were made into little booklets, the fascicles, were all hidden in the maid's trunk. And Emily had made her promise to burn them when she died. And that she hadn't done that, I thought, well, I got to write about this woman. She's kind of amazing in that she, by not following her mistress's orders at that point, she saved them for the rest of us. So.
Right. Did Emily publish any in her while she was living?
I think there were about, I may be wrong about this, but I think there were about 7 published.
That's it.
Like the newspapers. Yeah, she didn't. I think she really was uncomfortable with that, but she also, people didn't really want, she tried to get some published, more published, but her poetry was not the standard poetry of the day. It didn't have the kind of rhymes people wanted, and she had all these weird dashes and things like that that people didn't, you know, really know what to do with. They didn't feel it really qualified, or plus she was a woman, so it was sort of almost considered second rate. So she didn't get much published. I think there were people that recognized her genius but didn't feel that they could really publish and make anything of it. So
if it wasn't for Margaret, we wouldn't even have all these poems and wouldn't even know how brilliant Emily Dickinson really was. So,
well, we might, I mean, there was some, she shared a lot with her sister-in-law, Susan Dickinson, who lived next door, and she was very close to, and possibly some people, you know, you can make a good case that they were lovers at one time anyways. But she was probably her first reader and best reader. And she certainly had some of them, because Emily would also send them out, some of her poems, to friends. So they would be included in letters often, or as little gifts. And so there were people that had them, but it would have been a real headache to collect them all. And I don't think they didn't have all of them. Mm-hmm. Well, the bulk were in the trunk.
It's just so amazing to think that we were so close to never knowing, you know, if it was the wrong person.
Right. If she'd followed her orders, we wouldn't have them.
Right.
And some of those poems are the ones that she's most famous for now, like the one about not stopping for death, and
right,
the ones we really know well. Oh, because they couldn't stop for death, you know.
Right. I'm glad that you wrote this book about her. That was very nice of you. So how did you approach your research for this book?
Well, I love the research. I probably love it too much because I spend an awful lot of time on it. But I started by reading everything I could in Emily Dickinson. Then I read Maid is Muse. And from Maid is Muse, I basically read everything that was referenced in there that I could get my hands on. There's actually a lot. Once you start digging for things, I found this with my other books too. Once you start digging, you find more and more, and one source will lead you to another one. So I start by trying to get as much information as I can, kind of compare and contrast. When it comes to Emily, I had, there are many different biographies out there and books that have takes on her, and they don't all agree. So there's, you kind of, one of the problems with is sifting that out. It's not like all the scholars agree about what caused her reclusiveness or her sexuality or all those things, or why she was the way she was. So there's lots and lots of different takes. So I had to kind of settle into what felt right to me, and putting it through having all come through Margaret Marr's eyes meant it. I also had to sift it through an Irish sensibility, an Irish Catholic sensibility. So I did a lot of research on Ireland at that time, and I went into finding out as much as I could about where she came from and what it would have been like to emigrate to the United States at that time for an Irish person, and where she grew up, and lots of little detail stuff that never actually made it into the book. But it gave me by doing that, and I also researched the people that she worked for before, the Dickinsons, the Boltwoods, and doing that, even though it doesn't make it into the book, it kind of puts her in my head so that I, when I'm writing from her point of view, I have access to her past history, her story, and her ways of looking at things. So I did all that. I looked at the language, not Gaelic, but the Irish English way that they spoke. I did a lot of research on that too. Just lots and lots of things.
Did you go over to Ireland?
No, I was tempted to, but I didn't. No. I'm not a great traveler. I love traveling in New England. I'm pretty provincial. But I did do a lot of research about Ireland, but I didn't go there. Someday maybe.
You've been to the house though, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, I've been there several times. Uh-huh. And before it was, now it's, well, I was there. I didn't go before it was a museum, but I went since. I've been two or three times. And I'm super excited about what they're doing now. They're doing this renovation, massive renovation. And they've done some work. They've done some work already. But since I last visited it, they've reconstructed the conservatory, which had been taken down by a previous owner after the house was sold, and all that's, there's some of that hinting in the book.
Right.
But eventually they're reconstructing. They've redone Emily's room so it looks the way it did when she was alive. Now they're working on the parlors, and I guess they're going to be working on the dining room, other rooms. Eventually they want to do the kitchen and the servants' quarters, which I was really excited about. So they're doing a lot of work, and maybe eventually they're going to reconstruct the barn. We'll see, but it's kind of neat.
It's a big house, huh?
It's a good, I mean, you know, it's a big New England house, but not huge. It's not a, I don't know. It all depends. It's not like the Newport houses.
Yeah, yeah.
It's pretty, as someone who's walked by it several times, it's pretty big, in my opinion, but you know, I guess when you look at the houses that were contemporaries of it, I guess, would you consider it standard, Amy?
Yeah, for that era, it was definitely standard. Well, it was expanded. Edward Dickinson expanded it, but he made it bigger. But it was, yeah, I mean, it's a sort of standard New England house for,
I guess,
for
if wealthy, you had money.
For somebody who had money, yes.
Definitely. Right. You had to have money. It wasn't a standard house for
that's right.
Somebody who didn't have money. we have to make sure that's clear. It wasn't. Yeah. You know, they had servants and they had money, obviously.
Yeah.
I'm curious. So why do you think, you know, for you, why does her poetry still resonate so much?
Okay. Well, for me, I find her poetry and Emily herself still mysterious, even after all, the work I did, all the research I did, she's somewhat of a mystery. But her poetry, first of all, I'm grabbed by the way she uses language. And that's partly because I love playing with language and I love, right, you know, using words to make beautiful, beautiful constructions and using words and what impact they have. The way she uses words is, I don't know anyone that does it that way. She's amazing. So that's the big thing. And the other thing for me, it's kind of funny, but some of her, I don't think, there are some poems of hers that are quite accessible, but many of them I think are multi-layered and they're even confusing. I found most of them are quite short, but I found that when I was reading them, I couldn't read too many at a time because it was just too much. It was almost like it gave me a headache if I, each one, they're like little jewels and I wanted to contemplate each one and spend time with each one. So that's my reaction. But I don't know that an English scholar, English professor would say they might have a better take on why she resonates with so many people. There may be a certain level in which you can project your own thoughts and feelings onto them with some of them. And they also, for me anyways, they always sort of seem to open a door into some new thoughts and something I hadn't thought about.
Have you taught Emily Dickinson?
No.
Oh,
I've
okay.
taught writing. I've never really taught literature. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. What did you do before you were writing?
I started writing when I was about 9. I mean, just always wanted to write. So I read a lot. But the things I've done with my life, and I'm very old school. I feel like I'm a throwback. Well, I am another generation, but I married a minister and, I didn't set out to do that, and then I had a bunch of children. I have 4 children. So I did a lot of childcare and I did work. I did temp work a lot. I worked at the Orchard House, Museum in Concord, Massachusetts, where the Alcotts lived, which I love that job. And then eventually I got my MFA and in part so I could teach. But it wasn't that I loved teaching, it was that I loved writing. And I mean, it was okay teaching, but I ended up teaching mostly composition.
So wait a second. So you worked where the Alcotts lived?
Yes, I did.
Are we going to see Louisa May's house as a follow up to this?
No, not right away. I think it's, I've thought of it. I've thought of writing about her mother. There's been a lot written about her. And I also, when I write something, when I choose a subject, I'm interested in exploring stuff I don't know too much about. I mean, I could talk for a long time about the Alcotts, but I'm not sure, which is a wonderful family, fascinating. But I'm not, at this point, I don't feel, I find I have to have a lot of energy and a lot of drive in order to embark on a novel, because for me, it's a long process. And I dedicate I eat and drink it and I wake and sleep it, if you will.
So, how long did it take you to write Emily's House?
Oh, that took me about, the book Flight of the Sparrow was published in 2014. And Emily's House was finished in 2020. So it's a long time. So about 6 years, 6-7 years. Six. And that's, for me, short. But I don't write, you know, I'm not interested in cranking out books. I'm interested in exploration and discovery and using words in a way that will evoke feelings and experiences for the reader.
What is your process? Do you outline or do you just fly by the seat of your pants?
Yeah, I'm more of a pantser.
Okay.
I start with a character and
you're
I start
a pantser. With me.
Yeah. And but I also, because I choose real life people, I've done that. There is a constraint. It's not an outline at all, but there's, you know, I don't feel comfortable just making them go off. And like with Margaret, I don't feel comfortable making her go off and marry Patrick and move to back to Ireland or something like that, you know, because she didn't do that. The real person stayed with the Dickinsons. So I have to find ways of fitting the real story into, or my story into the real story in a way. My process, so anyway, so, and then I do a lot of drafts. I find that the character comes alive once I've started to actually put them on a page in a scene. And so even though I have information about the character before I start, I put them into situations where they have to act, then I get to know who they are. It kind of goes from there and builds. But I've tried outlining. I've tried. In the middle of the process, it's much more useful for me. Like when I've got a draft or two, and then I try outlining. It works better.
So during your research or your writing, was there anything you found particularly surprising?
For this particular book? Why am I not? I can't think of anything off the top. I mean, I love following whatever's interesting and surprising to me. So I'm trying. I think to some extent I was kind of surprised about Otis Lord as being, that was a research, you know, that Emily was attracted to him, who didn't seem like a very attractive person to me. And I, you know, I don't understand all the reasons for it, but there was at least a informal engagement there. So I, historically, that was sort of surprising to me. I don't know. I can't think of, I'm sorry. I can't think of anything.
It's okay.
No, that's fine.
I think a lot of it's surprising. I just, nothing pops into my head. So.
Okay. And was there anything that you, well, you must have learned a lot of things about them that you didn't really know before you started writing the novel. I mean, there must have been so much.
Yeah, I didn't really, until I started writing the novel and digging into it, I didn't know really about Austin Dickinson's affair with Mabel Loomis Todd. And Mabel Loomis Todd, she played a big part in bringing Emily's poems to light. I didn't end up with a very good feeling about her after I'd done my research as a person, but she certainly did the literary world some, you know, she brought them into publication. And she changed some of them to make them acceptable.
Oh, really? She rewrote them?
Some of them, she actually rewrote the words. She did an awful lot. She took out the dashes, put in punctuation, gave them titles, which Emily never did. She did some of that stuff. And hers are the ones that are in the public domain, although they're all over. Her poems with the dashes are all over the place anyways, even though I think they're technically under copyright, because they weren't done that way until the 1950s. So they weren't published that way.
Well, so without giving anything away, what do you hope readers will take away from reading Emily's House?
I would hope that readers could take away an understanding less of the dynamic between the servants and the employers in upper middle class New England, and the experience of an Irish immigrant in those times when there was so much prejudice against the Irish and Catholics as a whole. That was my big thing. And also the fundamental thing is appreciate how much those people who are supportive of the famous people or the rich people or the prominent people or the leaders, how much of a real factor they play, how much influence they actually have, and how impoverished our whole culture would be without them. I think that those people who are overlooked, I would like a reader to pay a little more attention to that in their own lives, you know, the people that generally don't get appreciated or taken for granted.
Now, what kind of research did you do for finding out about what her brothers were doing in California?
That was most of that was all from Aoife's book. She had information. She did a lot of digging into, she read what correspondence there is, things that Margaret left, had written places. And so a lot of that comes from her. And she also interviewed family. Well, Margaret didn't have any descendants, but her brother did. Her brother-in-law did. So it comes from that, mostly her book.
So were the brothers successful in California, or were they just...
Well, one of them died.
Oh, okay. And
the other one, the youngest brother, became a rancher out there, and I think he was successful. He actually owned, I think he actually bought a mine or something. At one point, he did pretty well for himself. And he came back east, I think, at the very end of his life.
Yeah.
But just briefly, and he's buried there. And he and Margaret are buried in the same cemetery.
Wow. Yeah, because that was really, I'm not giving anything away. That was right from the very beginning. Her goal was just to earn enough money to get out to California and be with her brothers.
Right. Yeah. I think she had an adventuresome sort of spirit.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
But he had a sister in Amherst. So
right.
I think that was hard too. It's hard to leave your sister. So
right. Well, also there was more to it than that. She
definitely was.
I don't want to give that away, but not everybody's so nice.
No, I'm afraid not. And the use of power sometimes really hurt.
Yeah, because she really wanted to get out there. She said she had her clothes ready and she was all.
And that's actual. She did. I don't know about her clothes being ready, but he had made plans, definite plans.
One wonders what might have happened had it gone that way, whether poetry would have still happened or whether it would have been different. I mean, I suppose like in everybody's mind, one would hope that the poetry would have still happened, but it seems like there was so much contributing to the nature of it.
That's true. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think it was very typical in those days for maids to come and go, like might stay a few years, but they often would get married or had enough of being someone's, you know, live-in maid, and they would leave when they could. So she was unusual in staying as long as she did.
Well, she also wasn't working as hard as she worked at other places, especially in the beginning, because they were actually doing a lot of the work that.
Yeah, although I still think she worked really hard. I think it's hard for us in this day to appreciate how much people had to do.
Right. You know? I know we have washing machines, we have dishwashers, we have all the modern conveniences that they didn't have. So she still had to do all that. But it's rare that you would come into a house and the other members of the house were doing the dusting and the baking and, you know, so she definitely worked hard. I'm not saying she didn't. But are you working on anything else right now?
I'm just beginning research on a different kind of book that is set in, it's very beginning stages, so it might change, but it's set in Vermont and during the Revolutionary War period. And Vermont became a state, it became actually an independent republic in 1777 because it wasn't a colony. So before the revolution, it was being fought over by New York and New Hampshire, that territory, that's Vermont. Both the king, I don't know how they do this, but you know, the king in England had given New Hampshire the land up to the Hudson River. And then he decided that that New York could have the land to the Connecticut River. So that kind of made Vermont a sort of no man's land. Anyways, that was part of it. And then the revolution happened. So I'm setting it at a pretty turbulent time. And that, and then of course with the American Revolution, with the British troops in Canada and the American, that whole territory was crisscrossed by a lot of different people. And I found a woman historically who was a spy. So I'm interested in that.
Wow, that sounds great. Good. So this one is Massachusetts, and then you're going to do Vermont. Where were your other books?
They were both in Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
Because that's where I was living at the time. And there's also, Massachusetts has a really rich history. I mean, there's lots and lots to choose from. I have lived in Maine and Massachusetts, but Vermont is, it's almost like a book of my heart to want to write one that's set here, because that's where it came from. So
very nice. Vermont's beautiful. I had gone when I was a child. I haven't been in a while, but it's a beautiful state.
Thank you.
Yeah. Really,
I haven't been to Long Island, but I do have a daughter that lives in New York City.
So. Oh, okay.
So you're close. You can come over if you ever feel like it.
She can take me there. I'm not a city person at all.
Well, Long Island is not city. City.
No, she'd have to show me around.
Yeah, no, I'm not a city person. I definitely prefer the suburbs.
Right.
So we thank you so much for speaking with us at Turn the Page, Syosset Libraries podcast.
Well,
so I guess we'll look forward to your next book and we'll talk to you then.
Okay.
So I guess we're going to close this chapter of Turn the Page. I'm Evelyn and I'm here with
Jessica.
My library and also Amy Brown. Thank you so much, Amy. We really appreciate it. And everybody, Emily's house is available here at the library and also on Overdrive. So.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.